Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this Palm Sunday edition of our English feature program. Today we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's reflections for the start of Holy Week in There's More to the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus was arraigned before the procurator, Pontius Pilate, who questioned him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus responded, "As you say." Yet when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he made no reply. Then Pilate said to him, "Surely you hear how many charges they bring against you." He did not answer him on a single count, much to the procurator's surprise. Now on the occasion of a festival, the procurator was accustomed to release one prisoner, whom the crowd would designate. They had, at the time, a notorious prisoner named Barabbas. Since they were already assembled, Pilate said to them, "Which one do you wish me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, the so-called Messiah?" He knew, of course, that it was out of jealousy that they had handed him over. While he was still presiding on the bench, his wife sent him a message, "Do not interfere in the case of that holy man. I had a dream about him today, which has greatly upset me." Meanwhile, the chief priests and elders convinced the crowds that they should ask for Barabbas and have Jesus put to death. So when the procurator asked them, "Which one do you wish me to release for you?" they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "Then what am I to do with Jesus, the so-called Messiah?" "Crucify him," they all cried. He said, "Why? What crime has he committed?" But they only shouted the louder, "Crucify him." Pilate finally realized that he was making no impression and that a riot was breaking out instead. He called for water and washed his hands in front of the crowd, declaring as he did so, "I am innocent of the blood of this just man. The responsibility is yours." The whole people said in reply, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." At that, he released Barabbas to them. Jesus, however, he first had scourged, then he handed him over to be crucified. The procurator's soldiers took Jesus inside the praetorium and collected the whole cohort around him. They stripped off his clothes and wrapped him in a scarlet military cloak. Weaving a crown out of thorns, they fixed it on his head and stuck a reed in his right hand. Then they began to mock him by dropping to their knees before him, saying, "All hail, King of the Jews!" They also spat at him. Afterward, they took hold of the reed and kept striking him on the head. Finally, when they had finished making a fool of him, they stripped him of the cloak, dressed him in his own clothes, and led him off to crucifixion.
Time was when the gospel for this day was looked on as a kind of marathon. Who would last out the longest? Standing, that is. At school, the nuns promised that if we managed to keep perfectly still for the whole of what was known as the long gospel, we'd help to reduce the time souls were serving in purgatory. Well, those were the days. Today, with the reform of the liturgy, not only do we not have a long gospel, we even have a short form of the shorter gospel. And so we're plunged headlong into the trial of Jesus before Pontius Pilate, the Roman procurator or prefect of Judea and Samaria, the man who's gone down in history as the one who ordered the crucifixion of our Lord, but also for certain words and gestures during the trial. "What is truth?" said jesting Pilate, and would not stay for an answer. These opening words of Francis Bacon's essay on truth, published in 1625, were taken up 300 years later by another essayist, Aldous Huxley, who entitled a collection, Jesting Pilate. Whether Pilate was jesting or not, we shall never know. We know only that when Jesus declared that he came into the world to give testimony to the truth, Pilate exclaimed, "What is truth?" and then turned away. Ever since, people have been asking themselves what he meant by his question. Truth? Is that all? Suggests Sheed, reminding us that the Roman Empire was littered with philosophers, sophists, and mystics.
The Roman civil service was trained to treat them with a sort of contemptuous tolerance. There might even be something in the stuff they were talking, but nothing that interested practical men above all, nothing that threatened Roman dominion. The Jesus whom they wanted him to kill for them was evidently one of that mystical sort.
H.V. Morton offers a different view.
Pilate looked into the eyes of Christ and expressed in three words the hunger of the pagan world. What is truth?
John is the only one of the evangelists who reports this celebrated question. Let's listen to it in context, in the Jerusalem Bible version.
So you are a king, then, said Pilate. It is you who say it, answered Jesus. Yes, I am a king. I was born for this, I came into the world for this, to bear witness to the truth, and all who are on the side of truth listen to my voice. Truth, said Pilate, what is that? And with that he went out again to the Jews and said, I find no case against him.
And immediately Pilate offers to release a prisoner according to the Passover custom.
Would you like me then to release the king of the Jews?
We know what the answer was. Another celebrated phrase of Pilate's is also reported only in John. But before that comes the scourging, ordered by Pilate in the hopes that when the people see Jesus afterwards, they will be moved by pity. Writes a modern scholar.
Pilate, by now convinced of the innocence of Jesus, makes a series of attempts to find a way of freeing him. The aim of these is to influence the people who had been incited by the Jewish leaders. Thus, he wishes to achieve justice by devious ways without meeting the difficulties and the unpopularity which justice often brings.
And so Jesus is scourged. And hearing that this prisoner has been accused of wishing to make himself king, the soldiers decide to have some fun with him, wrapping him in a scarlet military cloak, weaving a crown out of thorns, and putting a reed for a scepter in his right hand. The thorns, we're told, were taken from the faggots which the soldiers kept for lighting fires with which to keep themselves warm during the night watches. And so to that celebrated phrase recorded by John as the scourged and bleeding prisoner is shown to the crowds. Ecce homo. Behold the man, said Pilate. Writes H.V. Morton.
There was no contempt in his voice. They were the words of a weak but fair-minded man, who hoped that the piteous spectacle of the scourged Christ would soften the savage hearts of his enemies. Ecce homo. The sight is one that has aroused the pity and the love of the Christian world.
Many are the artists who have depicted this moment, but in the May of 1373, it was granted to a young woman of 30, apparently at the point of death, to see what no artist saw. But she was no ordinary young woman. Julian of Norwich, in her Revelations of Divine Love, wrote afterwards of her desire to fully experience and understand our Lord's passion, wanting his pain to be her pain, not wanting a physical vision or revelation of God, but, she said, such compassion as a soul would naturally have for our Lord Jesus. And this is what she saw.
I saw the red blood trickling down from under the garland, hot, fresh, and plentiful, just as at the time of his passion. Great drops of blood rolled down from the garland like beads, seemingly from the veins, and they came down a brownish red colour, for the blood was thick, and as they spread out, they became bright red. They were as fresh and living as though they were real. Their abundance, like the drops of water that fall from the eaves after a heavy shower, falling so thickly that no one can possibly count them. Their roundness, as they spread out on his forehead, were like the scales of herring. I was reminded of these three things at the time: round beads as the blood flowed, round herring scales as it spread out, and raindrops from the eaves for their abundance. This revelation was real and lifelike, horrifying and dreadful, sweet and lovely.
A poet of our own day, R.S. Thomas, no mystic he, but a deeply religious Welsh clergyman, reflects in a country church. To one kneeling down, no word came, only the wind's song, saddening the lips of the grave saints, rigid in glass, or the dry whisper of unseen wings, bats, not angels, in the high roof. Was he balked by silence? He kneeled long and saw love in a dark crown of thorns blazing and a winter tree golden with fruit of a man's body. Many hymns have been written on the theme of Christ crowned with thorns. One in particular, dating from the 13th century, was harmonised by Bach. Here are the words of the first verse in Ronald Knox's translation of what is known as the Passion Chorale.
O sacred head, ill-used by reeds and brambles scarred, that idle blows have bruised and mocking lips have marred, how dimmed that eye so tender, how wan those cheeks appear, how overcast the splendour that angel hosts revere.
There's another hymn or carol which, though fanciful, I find as moving as any of the more realistic, historically accurate ones. The Crown of Roses is also known as Tchaikovsky's legend, for he set it to music in 1883.
When Jesus Christ was yet a child, he had a garden small and wild, wherein he cherished roses fair and wove them into garlands there. Now once, as summertime drew nigh, there came a troop of children by, and seeing roses on the tree, with shouts they plucked them merrily. "Do you bind roses in your hair?" they cried in scorn to Jesus there. The boy said humbly, "Take, I pray, all but the naked thorns away." Then of the thorns they made a crown, and with rough fingers pressed it down, till on his forehead fair and young red drops of blood like roses sprung.
And our thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who produced and presented this edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now we take a look once again at the past week's events here in the Vatican. Our resident Vatican expert, Joan Lewis, sits down with Susie Hodges to review some of the highlights of the past 7 days, beginning with Pope Benedict's visit to the San Lorenzo International Youth Centre last Sunday.
There were about 200 young people from various continents who work in the center, who collaborate in the youth center's activities, and they were attending the Pope's Mass because the church really is not that big. It's something I don't even know if you can see from the street. Now, what was interesting about the Pope's Mass was the fact that he began his prepared homily, and then, as he is wont to do on a number of occasions very frequently during the Wednesday audience, he put that homily aside, and he continued with improvised, with off-the-cuff remarks on the meaning of life and death in the light, of course, of the gospel reading of last Sunday, which was the raising of Lazarus from the dead. And the Pope said, human beings, though part of this cosmos, transcended. And he said, of course, man always is man in his dignity, even if he is in a coma or embryonic state. And yet, he said, even if he lives, however, only biologically, there is much more to this than this, to his being, to the potential of his being. And man is called to new dimensions. So the Pope was really highlighting the physical and the spiritual. And then as the Pope kind of returned really to the topic of science and medicine, of life, of prolonging life.
He warned about immortality.
He did.
You know. Yes, very interesting.
And this perhaps certainly was one of the, or maybe the most interesting thing he said in the morning. And he talked about the medicine, even if medicine were to find a prescription against death, the prescription of immortality, how many times have we heard about in our life about the fountain of youth? He said it would be easy to imagine what would happen if man's biological life were endless, if he were immortal. He said we would find ourselves in an aged world, a world full of old people, a world that would leave no space for the young, for the renewal of life. So he said, thus we understand this cannot be the kind of immortality to which we aspire. The immortality to which we aspire, obviously, is union with God. It's the communion into the infinite love of God, which is the source of life. So for improvised remarks, it was a wonderful lesson.
Indeed,
really.
Very profound. Now, yeah. Coming to Monday, we had this three-day meeting in the Vatican, didn't we, to discuss the life of the church in China.
Well, you know, this is just a little over a year after a meeting that the Pope called in January of 2007 to discuss the life of the church in China. And that out of that meeting, actually several months later, came the Pope's very long, very extraordinary letter to Catholics in China, and to members of the Catholic Church in China. And the interesting thing about the meeting, this meeting on Monday, because we've kind of been, China makes the front pages of church news, you know, every so often, every a few months or something, and also because one of the big problems is that what you have in China is, first of all, China and the Vatican did once have diplomatic relations. They broke them in 1951, 2 years after the communists came to power. And ever since then, in those more than 50 years, the Catholic Church has had a very uneasy relationship with the government-approved Patriotic Association, which exercises supervision over mainland China's Catholics, often ordains bishops without a papal mandate and so forth. Now, then you have the underground church, loyal to Rome, loyal to the Pope, which is very often the government does try to suppress that. They have not done this at all.
Although the divisions between the two have been blurring of late.
Of late, there have been contacts, there have been talks, some resulting very publicly, others very much behind the scene. And I know it was John Paul's dream, and it certainly is his successor. It is Pope Benedict's dream, I think, to have these diplomatic relations with the church in China, that can never come about until there is full freedom, there is freedom of religion. So very interesting. Of course, we had the among those present was the Cardinal of Hong Kong, the Archbishop of Hong Kong, Cardinal Zen. So I'm sure that that was a very interesting input from his part.
Okay, so coming to Tuesday, it was quite a quiet day. It's usually the day where Pope Benedict does less, isn't it? But there was a communique that was released about Cardinal Bertone's just concluded trip to Armenia and Azerbaijan. Tell us something about that.
Exactly. The Secretary of State went to those two countries, and actually his trip was supposed to be a week long starting on March 2nd, but there was a state of emergency declared in Armenia, many, many recent protests and so forth. So he did go to Armenia. His trip was just curtailed ever slightly. But he did meet with His Holiness Karakhin II, who's the Supreme Patriarch and Catholicos of all Armenians, and naturally the Secretary of State also met with representatives of the Catholic community, which is a distinct minority in the country. And he was only there for, I think it was like 2 days. Then on March 6th, he went to Azerbaijan, where in the capital, interestingly enough, now again, this is a land of, I think it's 94% Muslim, the cardinal inaugurated a church and a new Catholic church,
Church of the Immaculate Conception.
Right. And he said this is a sign of true religious tolerance, again, a land of a Muslim majority. And several days later, he would celebrate Mass at that church. So that was, again, a very highly significant moment.
And there was also the moment that the cardinal visited a mosque in Baku, wasn't
he did
there?
Indeed. He visited a mosque, and he also, and then the head of the Muslims in the Caucasus received the cardinal in his own residence, along with other religious leaders of the Orthodox Church and the Jewish community. And in fact, the cardinal kind of expressed his closeness to the Orthodox. He did participate in a prayer of welcome at the Orthodox Cathedral, and then he went to visit the synagogue of Baku. So we have interreligious relations and a dialogue for Christian unity, interreligious. So I think, and the cardinal's a very affable man. He makes friends quite easily, establishes relationships quite easily, I'm told. So you never know what something like this will lead to. And obviously he speaks for the Holy Father. So that lends a certain gravitas to any visit. So now we know that Tuesdays, as you said, are quiet because the Pope is generally preparing for the Wednesday audience. And,
right. When it comes to the audience, once again, it was divided, wasn't it, into two parts. This seems to be becoming a habit now.
It was indeed. We think with bad weather, when you have an overflow crowd that's too big for the Paul VI hall, the Pope receives quite a number of pilgrims in the Vatican Basilica first and then goes to the audience hall. And then when the weather gets nicer, the larger crowds, of course, can go into St. Peter's Square. We've seen chairs. The chairs are set up, and obviously for all of the Holy Week ceremonies as well. So he spoke to the group, which was mainly Italian students in St. Peter's Basilica, about education and the challenges that schools face today, where they are called to offer students the opportunity to understand cultural, social, ethical, and religious messages. What I loved, he urged young people to update their spiritual formation for an ever greater understanding of their faith, so that you will be able, he tells them, to respond without hesitation to those who ask you why you follow the Lord. Why are you Christian, in other words? And then it was a different subject matter when the Pope moved to the Paul VI Hall. He had his, should we say, typical Wednesday catechesis, no longer on a father of the Church, but on two important Christian writers,
Boethius and Cassiodorus,
who they both lived after the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. And so the Pope noted, that both of them were anxious to preserve the heritage of Greek and Roman learning handed down through generations of Christian believers. This was in the context, of course, of the Gothic culture that dominated Italy at the time. Now, Boethius was born in Rome about 480, entered public life, became a senator. He was unjustly imprisoned, but, said the Pope, he wrote his greatest philosophical work in prison, concluding that true happiness is our hope in God despite all adversity. And then the Pope, talking about Boethius's contemporary, Cassiodorus, said he devoted much time and energy to promoting the monastic movement, and the Pope suggested we should very much follow his advice, Cassiodorus's advice, meditate day and night on the law of the Lord and focus your attention on Christ.
Okay, well, coming and now to the coming days, of course, we're coming up to the Holy Week, and there's going to be a mass of liturgical celebrations. But starting on Thursday this week, the Pope presided at a penitential rite, didn't he,
with young people? With young people in St. Peter's Basilica in the late afternoon, and talked about the importance of penance, which has actually dominated a few headlines recently. He met with the Apostolic Penitentiary, which handles the sacrament of penance. But the Pope did confess a number of young people. That had to be an extremely moving, wonderful, memorable experience for all of them.
And at the end of that Mass, apparently a group of young people brought in the Holy Year Cross, didn't they?
We link it with the event earlier in the week because they took the Holy Year Cross and brought it to the San Lorenzo Youth Center, which we said, of course, the Pope was celebrating Mass last Sunday at the center. They brought the youth cross there because that is where it's kept. It is kept in the church all year long unless it is taken out for a special event as it was for Thursday. So,
and it was given to them, I gather, by Pope John Paul in 1984.
At the very first World Youth Day, indeed. And then you have Palm Sunday, which as we are talking, the celebrations are about to begin because we do record this a little bit earlier than the Sunday event. But Palm Sunday is always on a diocesan level World Youth Day. The international celebration is every 2 or 3 years. We know it'll be in July in Sydney, Australia. And so the Pope presides at the Palm Sunday blessing of the palms, blessing of the olive branches, the liturgy in St. Peter's Square for Palm Sunday, the procession. And all the events linked with that. And that, of course, Sunday marks the very beginning of Holy Week, which is a very intense liturgical time, not only for the Holy Father. He's the Bishop of Rome. His celebrations in Rome are multiplied thousands of times over throughout the world, in parishes, in dioceses, by cardinal archbishops of major archdioceses and so forth. So a very intense weekend for all of us as Christians, as we participate in the same liturgies, the way of the cross, the institution of the Blessed Sacrament. And I have to say that about 2 weeks ago, attending Mass in the upper room, in the cenacle, in Jerusalem, was an extraordinary experience. Just going to communion is different after that. And I was a lector at Mass, so it was very memorable for me. As I'm sure the coming week will be for all of our listeners, wherever they are in the world and wherever they celebrate Holy Week.
Thanks there to Joan Lewis, taking a look back over events here in the Vatican over the past 7 days and looking ahead to the events of Holy Week. And that's all from us here at the English Programme for today. We'll be back, of course, at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. If not, why not look it up on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.